Broadcasting from a device built by a teenage genius using leftover parts from an erector set, this is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Sci-Fi for Me Radio on the air here in the Echo Chamber. Jason Hunt in the bunker with everybody else joining online. My co-host over on H2O, Mr. Timothy Harvey, joins us by phone.
Hello there.
And Tim and I started this conversation on H2O. We had a couple of different episodes, one in which we talked about the Axanar lawsuit brought on from Paramount and CBS, and then part two of that ranged over into a case that could be going to the Supreme Court involving cheerleader uniform designs and the possible impact it could have on cosplay. And after those two conversations, we decided, you know, we should open this up and have a broader scope conversation about the copyright issues and the Axanar case itself, but also the other things. So joining me on the Ansible from Corpus Christi, Texas, Sonia Rodriguez.
Hello.
And from Kansas City here, Dan Handley.
Hello.
And from the island of Grenada, our guest, he is the editor-in-chief at 1701 News, has been following the Axanar case rather closely. Mr. Michael Hinman joins us as well.
Hello, everybody.
Michael, let's start with the latest details, because there have been some developments in the Axanar case this week. It got really big amounts of monies. Paramount and CBS came in and said, we don't like that. Here's the lawsuit that you're infringing on copyright. And Axanar's lawyers have filed for a dismissal. And where are we now at this moment?
Well, I mean, so basically the defense has responded to the lawsuit with a motion to dismiss or strike. This is a standard procedure by defenses in civil cases like this. And basically, it's not a defense. This is not laying out why Axanar believes they are in the right. It's none of that. What it is, it's basically a technical challenge. They're basically saying, all right, here's your case. Did you file everything correctly? Did you dot all the I's, cross the T's? It's when we hear about things being thrown out on technicalities. So it's really nothing more than buying time, because even if they, in a rare case, that they are successful in some way or another with this type of motion, all that would do is cause CBS and Paramount to amend their complaint or just refile it. So it just extends the time a little bit that all this would go through. But that's where we're at. And right now, both sides have said that they'll be willing to do a hearing on this right after Easter. And that's where we're at. We're going to probably see in the next couple of weeks, I think, is the deadline for CBS and Paramount to respond to it. And then Axanar will have a chance to respond to that. So it'll be some back and forth until they fight this out. So this is like still pre-game stuff right now. Like, we're not even into the game yet.
Right. Now, we were talking about having we had invited Don Simon, who's an intellectual property copyright lawyer, to join us as well. And he ended up with a schedule conflict and was not able to join us. But we are going to have a discussion with him at some point really, really soon, because he finds this to be a really interesting case as well. Because one of the things that we've talked about on a number of occasions, the fact that fan films in general, if you really look square in the face at copyright law, fan films and such, fan fiction and that kind of thing, are technically violations of copyright. And over the years, the studios have pretty much turned a blind eye to most of it. And the thinking here, us being laymen and not specialists on all of this, the thinking here basically is, well, it's marketing that they don't have to pay for. It's advertising they don't have to buy. So as long as it's presenting your material in a way that they find acceptable, and as long as people can really just look at it and they know this is not the official real thing, there hasn't really been a whole lot of noise about it. However, there have been occasions where things have been taken down off of YouTube, things have been, they get spiked for the copyright ding. And this one seemed to be humming along pretty well until it suddenly wasn't. And there was a lot of speculation online wondering when CBS would bring the hammer down on these guys, mainly because of the fact that, one, it got so big with the money, but two, how that money is being spent. And this is something that Tim and I had talked about early on, the fact that a lot of this money that's been spent so far has been on salaries for Alec Peters and others in the production staff, and also renting out a warehouse facility that they've been converting into a soundstage. Now, for those of you who are not in Los Angeles, a lot of us here on staff, we've done independent film productions. So understanding how this works is kind of inside baseball here. But in Los Angeles, which is, you know, home to Hollywood, where they make movies and TV shows sometimes, there are probably one or two sound stages already built and outfitted and ready to go, and all you got to do is rent it. And Michael, you guys had an article from an indie filmmaker who was looking at all of the expenditures that have been reported so far. And the question now is, why would they bother to spend so much money to convert a warehouse to a soundstage when they could spend less money and rent one? And that kind of triggers that speculation there that the Axanar people are spending money to set up a for-profit operation, something I think they're calling Ares Productions.
Yeah, it's not even speculation that they're doing that. They've come out and said it. I mean, they said it multiple times, and it's stated in the lawsuit that CBS and Paramount has filed. And you know, and that's the thing. Like, I haven't produced anything independent yet. I'm in pre-production for a web series that I co-wrote, and we've been in pre-production forever because you know we're independent. You know, we're not doing it for a lot of money. But I can tell you, even in Tampa, you know, which is where we're going to be filming this in Florida, which isn't exactly a Hollywood mecca, it's not exactly a place where there's a soundstage on every corner, we're going to be renting out soundstage space. And I can tell you we're not going to be spending $300,000. We'd be like if we spend $3,000.
Right.
And there's no need to be doing this. There's no need. They found a space that doesn't even have the correct electrical infrastructure to film. And, I mean, they're going to have to spend all this money to retrofit that. And it makes absolutely no sense. And that, you know, and I think that's where Paramount and CBS put their foot down. It's like, you're not funding a fan film. You're funding a commercial venture, which is the studio.
Right, which then becomes a huge violation of the whole, you know, you're using somebody else's material in order to profit. And you know Peters has thrown out the comparisons, well, we're just another fan film, we're just like Star Trek Phase 2, Star Trek Continues, and we did throw out invitations to James Colley and Vic Mignogna to join us. Colley politely declined, said he'd like to keep his thoughts to himself, and Vic we never heard from, but I'd understand that he's traveling, so it's possible he's just out of touch, out of pocket. But, you know, for Alec Peters to sit there and on the one hand make the comparison, well, we're just another fan film, but then in the same breath talk about how his production is so much better than those other little piddly little thing, amateur productions, you know, looking down his nose at Phase 2 and Continues and all the others. He's sending out mixed signals. Are they a fan film? Are they a professional thing? Because he's claimed to be both at this point.
What it sounds like to me is you got somebody who wants to do his own production company, and he's utilizing the fan film as a promotional tool. So he may not profit directly from the fan film. By doing the fan film, he can show off to everybody, hey, here's what we could do. Now give us money for the real thing.
Except that's not what he's doing. Because the prelude to Axanar short film that we got, that we actually have seen out there, that's out there, it's gorgeous. I mean, the production value on it is really, really, really nice. That, no question. And that was used to raise money, ostensibly, they claim, to make the Axanar film. I mean, that was the whole goal. It wasn't, hey, look at what we can do. Give us money so we can do a brand new original thing.
Yeah, that was a question I had. Did they start the Kickstarter fund after Prelude to Axanar was released or prior?
I want to say it was prior, wasn't
it? Oh, wow. I think it was prior, but I'm honestly not sure.
I don't know.
Because it makes a little bit of a difference. Because if you're going back to like, okay, this is what we can do. Give us more money so we can do it. You know?
Right.
And then open up the Kickstarter account. But if the Kickstarter account was open before that, then he's not really looking so great.
Well, to me, he's not looking great either way because...
Well,
Well, because if you...
It just adds more, what is this guy up to? Just another little log to his little fire.
If I remember seeing online some discussions, you know, comments back and forth, it would seem, and I could be wrong on this, it's been known to happen, but it seems like they made Prelude to Axanar prior to the Kickstarter launch because the comments that have been lately simmering and brewing around the internet are pretty much to the effect of, you raised all this money and you haven't spent it on any production. You haven't filmed anything yet. So that kind of suggests to me that the Prelude to Axanar was done first, then they launched the Kickstarter. Everybody got all hot to trot about it, and they raised over $1 million on Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and then they decided, hey, we're going to do... Now, then you have the question of whether or not there was ever any intention of making the Axanar film. Because if the whole thing was, let's make Prelude to Axanar so we can raise all this money so that we can go build our own studio, then you're talking a massive amount of fraud as well as copyright infringement.
Yeah, and I mean, and I'm sorry, I really don't even know what the timeline is for this. I'm not the person that generally covers fan productions. You know, there's enough of everything else out there that I have to kind of focus on. And so I really didn't jump into what was happening with Axanar until after the lawsuit was filed. Once that lawsuit was filed, I had to kind of go back and try to learn as much as I could of what was going on, ask different people. But I'm not quite sure what the timeline was. I do believe that there were multiple crowdfunding campaigns, if I remember from what people talked about. And I do believe that there was one ahead of Prelude. I believe there was a specific fundraiser for Prelude. And then there's been additional ones since then, because I believe that whenever we talk about the 1.1 million or so that's been raised, that wasn't from a single fundraiser. That was from at least two, maybe
several.
Three, I believe.
There was And what gets me is that they even talked about one of the articles. I can't remember which one it was. Talks about how it's, you know, one like thousandth of 1% of the amount of money that the Star Trek franchise even made, you know, just with their movies, their JJ movies. And they talk about how insignificant amount. I mean, yeah, $1.13 million, that's a lot of money to us. But to them, it's nothing.
Yeah, I think you might, Sonia, I think what you're referring to, at least my, I had a story where I kind of put the numbers in perspective. So I took the 8,500 donors that Fox News said contributed to Axanar. And what I did is I broke down the number of tickets sold in North America for Into Darkness in 2013 using the average ticket price.
There you go.
Box Office
Mojo. Yeah.
And if you were to say that those two audiences were the same people, you know, at least that they saw Into Darkness as well and supported Axanar, it would represent 0.03% of the total audience who saw Into Darkness, who bought tickets for Into Darkness.
Yeah, that math, it was very interesting. And when you look at it like that, it's so it's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. So why are they going after them? But then it comes into the whole, they're not talking about the 1.13 million. They're talking about the future millions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they want to put a stop to, or that's what they want a piece of.
Well, and it goes back to the speculation of whether or not they were actually going to make the Axanar picture to begin with. I mean, if their intentions were pure as the wind-driven snow, and they are planning to use this money to make the Axanar feature, you know, then okay, you're still making a high-dollar fan film using somebody else's material. And you still have to face the copyright issues, and it makes you wonder, because, you know, like he said, there, you know, like Peters has compared, you've got Star Trek Phase Two, you've got Star Trek Continues, you have Farragut,
New Voyager,
Farragut's
is
out
it
there.
What called New Voyager?
New Voyages and Phase Two have gone back and forth that title for that same project. But there's a number of Star Trek fan films, but A, they're all obviously amateurs. No matter how good the sets look, you've got some actors on every cast that are not all that great. Or you've got the fan productions where they're using virtual sets and everything's green screen and you can really tell that this is a fan production. Or you get the parodies and you get the spoofs and that sort of thing. But, you know, this idea that, I don't know, Peters just strikes me as coming off feeling like he should be untouchable. Because, well, other fan films get away with it. We should be able to get away with it.
But, you know, and that's where, and I think that's one of the major flaws that Axanar has brought into this, where they believe that because that CBS and Paramount, that they haven't gone after other fan productions, that should clear them as well. But Peters himself has said that what these unspoken guidelines are from, you know, the ground rules, more or less, that are in place for these fan films, and he's basically violated every single one of them. And when it comes to the end of it, CBS and Paramount, they have every right to selectively enforce. Because trademark is different. If we're talking about trademarks, you have to be out there and you have to enforce it, or you could lose it.
Right.
But for copyright, if CBS and Paramount were to focus their energies to go after every single infringer of their copyright, that's all they would be doing. I mean, I just imagine, like, where people, they sometimes pick up a whole story of mine from 1701 News and they'll post it somewhere, like on a message board or something. You know, it's technically violating our copyright, but I'm not going to go after them. I'm not going to sit there and go after every single person, because then that's all I would be doing all day long. You know, I'd have to hire 10 people just to look for it and to enforce it. You can see that even in a large production like this, like Axanar, that you had, you know, it's 0.03% of the people who saw Into Darkness, who bought tickets for Into Darkness. Even a large production like that is so insignificantly small compared to the overall franchise that normally CBS and Paramount, they don't care. You know, just go ahead and do it. Please don't make any money off of it, and don't turn it into a commercial enterprise. But that's what Axanar said. It has nothing to do with the quality, because Star Trek Horizon just came out over the weekend, and if anybody should be up and get anybody up in arms over quality, that should be them. You know, they did a lot of really good things with that. And, you know, it's not about that. It's all about the fact that they have turned into raising all this money. It's like me saying, you know what, I'm going to make a Star Trek film. Give me a bunch of money. Now watch as I buy myself a mansion and a brand new car and everything with this money and take a trip to Tahiti. I mean, I'm not saying that they're doing all of that, but they're building a commercial enterprise with this money that if they had just gone out and said, hey, we want to build an independent film studio, and we just want to do certain things, I doubt they would have raised $1.1 million.
Right, yeah. The Star Trek name made all the difference for that.
Right.
Yeah, but then what it comes down to is, are they more in violation of the Kickstarter rules than anything else, because they're not focusing all of their attention on that one project? They're above and beyond.
Yeah, because the money you raise has to go to what you say you're going to do.
Exactly, right. And if they're kind of underhandedly spending it for other purposes, they could be looking at even bigger problems, you know, not beyond just copyright.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that either. Good point.
Depending on how it's presented on those fundraising sites, you could make the argument, if you squinted and tilted your head just right, you could make the argument that spending money on the facility is part of that production cost, the expense of actually making it. But since they haven't shot anything, up until this point, before, you know, prior to the lawsuit.
It's the greatest script ever written.
Yeah.
They're still tweaking it.
I can tell you, though, about the greatest script ever written, I can say that, at least from my understanding, it's not.
It's the greatest script that they've ever written.
Well, yeah. I can, you know, this is not out yet, so this is getting out right now. But I've been kind of digging around a little bit, hoping to dig up a version of the script. And, you know, at least something, because I was really curious, because they keep talking about how it's the greatest Star Trek of all time. I mean, Robert Burnett spent 90 minutes, you know, trying to convince me. And he even offered to send me the script if I agreed to his terms to do this live interview that I'd said no to. But let's just say that 1701 News has acquired at least two drafts of the Axanar script.
Hmm.
And we will be sharing details of that on Tuesday.
Ooh.
So is it the greatest script ever written?
It's the greatest. Granted, this is from the way I verified this, because I had to verify that this script was real. And I did. And it was verified as an earlier draft. So it's definitely not like the final draft. It might not even be the one that was locked in August, that they said, because they said it was locked like two times. It's been locked. Like, it's been basically, that means that the script is pretty much where they can print it out and distribute it. And if there's any changes, they would just send out individual pages. They wouldn't reprint the entire script.
Oh, okay.
So basically means that you're at a point where you're only making minor adjustments from there. So they've said twice now, even though their lawyer says that they don't have a finished script, but they've said it twice that they've locked the script. But I can tell you, and I have somebody else reviewing this, not me. Like, I'm just going to be doing just kind of it from a news perspective, and then somebody else.
Just in case it is the greatest script ever written, and you just kind of missed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm not a filmmaker, so I let a filmmaker take a look at it to see if it's the greatest script ever written. But I kind of glanced through it. You know, I skimmed through the whole thing. It definitely would not win any Oscars. It might win a Razzie. But the dialogue is just, and I mean, and I'm a little bit biased because I just, this whole production irritates me, but it's not Shakespeare at all. It's not even drunk Shakespeare. It's you know, it feels like people are, it's like if you get a bunch of your friends together, like when you're 12 and you want to play Star Trek. And you're like, oh, and you develop a story. And that's kind of what it's like. It's what I feel like that I was going through. It's like, it's a bunch of 12-year-olds wanting to pretend to play Star Trek. And I know fan films are like that in a way. It's adults wanting to play in the universe, and that's fine. But then, you know, but they're not calling it, hey, it's just a fan film. They're calling it the greatest Star Trek film that, you know, that they've ever read, that Robert Meyer Burnett's ever read. And it's like, if that's the greatest script he's ever read, then he hasn't read it.
Do they have the same promotional people as Donald Trump?
Seems like sometimes.
It was kind of funny because, you know, they had said that several times. And then they said they met with CBS, and then they had to tweak the greatest script ever. So I was like, okay, if you're meeting with these people and then you have to tweak the script, but their excuse was because they had to take out things that violated the copyright. And I'm like, this doesn't sound right. It sounds like somebody's lying.
Well, they think that they can just saw off the serial numbers, and that's basically what they're doing now. They feel that if they removed, and I've seen this discussed among them publicly, where they believe now that if they take out the Star Trek references and they change the aliens and they change everything else and they take out the references, then they're in the clear. But you're still going back to the same question of, you raised $1.1 million calling this Star Trek. You know, you're raising money on our property. Even if you end up not making our property, you're raising money on our property, and you still can't do that.
Yeah. And again, they run into the Kickstarter issue, because if you're not delivering what you promised on, you know, people gave money to a Star Trek project, and then they saw off the serial numbers, like you say, they send them off, and there you go. It's something completely different.
I think he's having trouble.
Yeah,
he's having trouble. I think Peters is having trouble with the whole, okay, if we're a fan film, we'll be okay. But he doesn't want to be a fan film. He wants to be a professional production.
Right.
And so if he can't be both and win.
Well, I find it funny that he's coming at this saying that or it may not be him, it could be, you know, some of the people on his comment boards talking about how Paramount is jealous. Oh, it's going to be better than it's better than Beyond. I was like, well, you know, it might not be a stretch, but I don't think that's what they're worried about. Just simply because you're talking, you know, massive difference in scale in terms of what kind of money you're going to be putting into a production like this, what Paramount's spending versus what Axanar would spend. But, you know, it's one of those things where everybody who creates something, either they worry that it's crap and it's terrible, and I never should have done this in the first place because it's so terrible and nobody's going to like it, like I do sometimes, or they are so full of themselves, they put this thing out there saying, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread, everybody's going to love it, and if you don't love it, you're an idiot. And it seems like the Axanar people are in that second camp. Maybe.
But does that help them to be there?
I don't think
so. Does it help their case?
I don't think so, because after they got hit with the lawsuit, there was a lot of back and forth online around the Facebook pages especially, basically saying, hey, look, Paramount sued us. Oh, you think they're going to win? Yuck, yuck, yuck. Let's go have dinner at a really expensive restaurant. They were basically celebrating the fact that they had just gotten sued.
Because they're getting free publicity.
Yeah,
right.
Well, there's that. And why? Okay, if they've got all of this money, why are their lawyers pro bono?
They're Star Trek fans.
Well, you know, and the thing about the reason why they're in that second camp, by the way, and where it's not successful for them in a legal strategy, but it's definitely successful for them in a crowdfunding strategy, because when there was something with extreme confidence, it's the Donald Trump thing. Like, you can be Donald Trump and say whatever you want, no matter how crazy and insane that it is, you can still say it. And as long as you say it with so much confidence that you're absolutely right, then people are going to follow you and listen to you, and they think you're right. If I went around and told everybody that, you know, 10 million people visit my website every single day, that they can't live without, you know, reading what's happening there, if I say that enough and I say it confidently enough, people might actually start believing that, and they're going to start visiting the site because they don't want to be left out. They don't want to be left out of this great big thing, even if it's not really true at all. You know, it's just – and that's the thing. By saying that this is the greatest Star Trek script ever, we're going to show how, you know, Paramount's so jealous of how wonderful we are and that we can do this and they can't. And if you have fans that are upset about whatever, because fans are always upset about something, that you're gonna be able to bring them in, and they're going to give money – you know, because they want to express that anger somehow, and they're going to get it with this greatest thing ever. So it's a great strategy as a carnival barker if you're trying to pull people into your, you know, into the big top tent to see your show. But it's not going to be great when the cops show up and need to shut it all down.
And, like, when did the Kickstarter thing shut down? When did they stop raising the money?
Oh, that would have been about a month.
Did it happen? Before or after CBS sued?
It was before the lawsuit. The Kickstarter was over after the lawsuit.
The Kickstarter continued on with stretch goals, I believe, and I believe that it didn't actually halt taking donations until maybe 2 to 3 weeks after the case was filed.
Oh heck yeah! Well, if they filed the Go ahead.
That's okay.
I was like, well, if it closed after they filed the lawsuit, well, I'd be laughing my way to the restaurant, too. Thanks for the publicity. You know, now everybody's, oh, they're making a fan film? That's all they heard.
Yeah. And I believe somebody mentioned, I haven't actually been there myself, so I'll qualify this statement so that nobody's like, oh, well, you weren't there. It's like, yeah, you're right, I haven't been there. But from what I understand, there's still a donate button if you go to the Axon.
Oh, really? Oh,
and
wow.
It's not necessarily crowdfunding, but you could still PayPal them some money, which, you know, people are going to do because, especially when you're, you know, in an echo chamber, no offense to this show, but when you're in an actual echo chamber, you know, where you don't have any dissenting opinions, where you're having all of the information brought in, controlled by somebody, and that's all you're looking at, because you're sequestered into this area where there's nothing else allowed in, no light's allowed to permeate. You're going to sit there and feel it's North Korea. They're going to feel like, you know, and they're going to keep putting in money because of that big bad Paramount, that big bad CBS.
Yeah,
jealous let's of this.
Stick it to the
so
man.
Badly don't want Star Trek fans to have real Star Trek. And they're going to keep giving their money.
They're just going to give the money and the principle of it all. You know?
So they're trying to set themselves up to either be heroes or martyrs, depending on how it turns out.
Or both. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is you've got, you know, like you said, Michael, everybody agrees. Everybody's on the same page that, you know, CBS isn't respecting their fans. They aren't looking at what the fans want and all of that. And I'm thinking, CBS doesn't have to care what the fans want. CBS has to care what makes them money on this on this property. You know, they're a for-profit company, and their concern is making money off of Star Trek, whether it's, you know, the new TV show, and people are griping about the whole all-access thing. I got to spend extra money to be able to watch this stuff online. But then, you know, you get the announcement that Nicholas Meyer is not going to be involved, and everybody goes, huh? Oh, well, that might be worth $6 a month. You know, so there's that back and forth, but CBS has a vested interest in Star Trek being profitable, and the people who are sitting here saying, "Oh, well, CBS was worried that Axanar threatens that profitability," they have probably not a very good understanding of how this works, because Axanar, however big that it is, however professional and glossy and shiny that it would look, it's not going to cut into CBS's profits on Star Trek. It just won't. I mean, for people to think that, they're highly misinformed.
Yeah, even the 1.1 million, I mean, yes, I'm sure CBS and Paramount would love to have that, you know, in their coffers and not Alec Peters' pocket, but that, you're right, it comes down to that, and really, it's not about money, because remember, profit does not have to be involved in a copyright case. Even Vic, you know, who does, you know, Star Trek Continues, you know, from what I understand, I looked over his 501c3 filings that he made, his 501c filings, and you know, and in there, he talked about the fact that he actually lost $25,000. He put in $25,000 of his own money, and he'll never see that coming back. He's never made any of that back. But that's part of, like, his own personal thing. Even with that, CBS and Paramount tomorrow could file a suit against him. And even though he's lost money, it doesn't matter. Profit doesn't have to be motivation. But the thing is that, and just like with Tommy Kraft, you know, who just came out with Star Trek Horizon that just was released this weekend, when I interviewed him a few weeks ago, we talked about Axanar a little bit, and he actually worked on Prelude to Axanar, and Alec Peters actually endorsed his Kickstarter. He had like a $20,000 Kickstarter. But he said, you know, the biggest thing is it would be just like if 20th Century Fox decided tomorrow they're going to make an independent Star Trek. You know, would that be legal? No. You know,
right.
Would CBS and Paramount sue them? Yes. And this is the same exact thing. You know, Peters is not, you know, 20th Century Fox by any stretch of the imagination, but he is a for-profit company that is paying himself, giving salaries to people, and, you know, is raising money calling this an independent film.
They're just basically trying to put lipstick on a pig and call it something else.
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of lipstick, let's switch gears for a little bit here and talk cosplay for a second. And there is a case that is possibly headed to the Supreme Court that has cosplayers a little concerned, and they might or might not have reason to. We will discuss that and more when the Echo Chamber continues right after this.
You're listening to the Echo Chamber on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Hi, this is Jason Hunt.
And I'm Timothy Harvey.
And we're the hosts of the H2O podcast. We're the H's, the O, of course, opinion. It's our weekly general discussion of this, that, and the other thing.
All sorts of things. Books, movies, video games, comic books, short stories. And sometimes we actually say things that make sense.
Sometimes we can be brilliant.
But not that often. And I'm clearly smarter than you.
Yes, which is why I let you talk so much. The H2O podcast, sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com, every week on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
I'm meteorologist Brian Busby. If you're traveling to a convention this weekend, especially if you're a cosplayer, it helps to know what the weather's going to be like. Rain and fur don't mix very well now, do they? That's why every week, Sci-Fi for Me gives you the weather forecast for every city hosting a convention. Those we have on our list, anyway. And that's worldwide, not just in the United States. It's part of our commitment to bring you content you won't find anywhere else. Just click on the Conventions tab over at scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Atomic Cotton, where Erica and Zach combine their passion for art and film to create wearable art. All original, made with a love for the genre. Coming to a convention near you very soon. Or find them on the web at atomiccotton.com. Atomic Cotton, shirts and art for fans by fans.
And now, back to the Echo Chamber on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Back in the Echo Chamber, Jason Hunt here, along with Sonia Rodriguez.
Hello.
And Dan Handley.
Hello.
Tim Harvey.
Hello there.
And from 1701 News, Michael Hinman.
Hello.
And we are discussing copyright and fan films and now cosplay, because there is a case that may be going to the Supreme Court that might have some impact on the cosplay community. Some people wonder. The specific case is Star Athletica LLC versus Varsity Brands, and it's basically a case that involves cheerleading uniforms. And this being a genre site, a genre show, we normally are not going to be talking about anything sports related, you know, because we're the ones that are always making the sports ball jokes. But the case basically is that one of these companies is saying, we own the copyright on these cheerleader uniform designs. And the other company says, well, you can't copyright clothes because it's a functional, it serves a purpose, and that sort of thing. So now the argument is that the specific design of this uniform is such that it could be copyrighted. You can't copyright the actual uniform itself, but the design elements. And it's got some people in the cosplay community worried, because if they make their case correctly, and if they win this case, that costume design, uniform clothing design can be copyrighted, then the impact, the possible impact of that, would be that all of these wardrobe designs from these movies now suddenly fall under copyright protection, maybe. It may be a stretch. It might not actually happen. But the cosplay community is worried that it might happen because, you know, everybody makes their own costumes. And you have here in the, you know, with the, especially with the Star Wars fans, you know, the 501st and the Rebel Legion and all those groups that have to make these uniforms in order to get their numbers and their membership numbers. They have to be screen accurate, which means they've got to be almost perfect replications of a design that you see in a film. I don't know if we're going to get to that extreme or not. So I want to just throw it out there. Is there a possibility that if it becomes such that a cheerleader uniform design can be protected by copyright, what does that mean for cosplay?
Just offhand, I'm thinking of, like, on the Axnar thing, you know, relating to this, is that what's the profit on it? Is somebody profiting from it? Now, Varsity may have a claim if they have a registered copyright or or justifiable trademark, and somebody else is profiting off of it. But if the profit isn't there, if it's just simply a cosplay, would they even bother to go after it?
Well, I think, yeah, I think selective enforcement is going to be in play on this as well. It's just like Michael said, that you don't have to be that rigorous in terms of protection. Trademark, yes, you do. But with copyright, your protection is guaranteed. If you do want to go after it.
There's a little bit of difference, though, too, when we're talking about cosplay, like where somebody's at home making their costumes, and even if it is, like, screen accurate to something, there's a difference between that and, I think, making a business out of it. And because like right now, like if I wanted to make my own Starfleet uniform, I could sit here, I could sew it, I could put it together, I could wear it to a convention and do all of this. I've never done that, by the way, but I could do that. But if I started then selling that pattern, or if I started making them and selling them, mm-hmm. I think that's where you kind of run into problems, because I know if I designed some type of a uniform, I designed some type of a costume, I would be pretty angry if somebody decided to suddenly make patterns of it or to actually start making it themselves and selling it and not cutting me in, because it's my creation. So I think it kind of comes back to that.
Well, and that makes me wonder, too, because I have wondered about this for a long time, for a number of years, how cosplayers and cosplay photographers could get away with selling photos of, you know, like, I mean, for example, Kara Nicole out in Arizona. She's known as Arizona Power Girl, or Yaya Han, or Jessica Negri, or any of those cosplayers that are actually selling photographs of them in costume, various different characters, where you do have that element of turning it into a business of sort. And my question has always been how they get away with that, because that is a technical violation of copyright, for one, because you're profiting off of intellectual property that belongs either, you know, belongs to Marvel, belongs to CBS, it belongs to DC or whoever. And then also the fact that you're actually selling this as a business. And whether you're a for-profit or not is kind of irrelevant. It's one of those things where there is money changing hands now. How do they get away with that without getting dinged? And I was hoping to get some cosplayers on the show today, but everybody is out making appearances at conventions over the weekend, so we didn't get anybody in. But that's been a long-standing question for me, is how they could. How they could get away with selling prints in the first place. So
you've also got the people who go out and make appearances, like you said, and some of them do it professionally.
Right.
And it's not even limited to a single manufacturer of, or, you know, single company copyright. Because, I mean, you know, I know a couple people who have done cosplay for Marvel in places, which is one thing, but I also know of other people who make appearances at parties and stuff dressed as, you know, Frozen characters.
Right.
Well, so, I mean, you've got more than just, you know, the photographic aspect.
Well, and the irony is I don't remember if it was the Avengers or if it was Thor, one of the Marvel movies, when it opened here in Kansas City, Marvel actually hired cosplayers to appear out at the movie theaters, if I remember correctly. So you actually have cosplayers making money, and I guess in that particular sense, the rules are a little bit different, because you actually have the copyright owners hiring them to portray these characters. So maybe that's a situation where it's all okay.
Yeah, that's basically, it's a license. I mean, it might not be an outright license that somebody might get in terms of doing a novelization or something. But, yeah, if you get hired, like let's say Disney decides to hire a bunch of stormtroopers, you know, like people who, you know, dress up as stormtroopers, yeah, I mean, they can get paid for that. Disney has every right to do, like, that type of a temporary license in a way and pay people to portray those and still later come down on them if they wanted to for violating those copyrights. So.
Right. Well, do we think that – and the cheerleader case, especially, I guess, is the one that everybody's looking at. What do you guys, do you think that a clothing design should be copyrightable? Should it be something that can be protected by copyright?
Well, it kind of depends on you know, you're going to have that argument of form and function, because certain things in terms of design are just, you know, you can't copyright a pair of jeans and say that, well, because they've got two legs and pockets in the front and pockets in the back, we own every jean that, you know, that's, we have the rights to all the jeans in the world. But if you have a, like the Dallas Cowboys cheerleader uniforms, that's part of the brand, that's part of the image. But, you know, there's also a limited number of cheerleading costume, you know, uniform designs out there. I mean, you know, you're not going to have like a head to toe solid outfit, because that's not what cheerleading outfits look like.
Yeah.
I mean, you could.
So it's basically going to be particular elements of stuff.
I think it has to be. I mean, I really can't see how you could legitimately say that, you know, if the only thing different from your cheerleading costume and somebody else's cheerleading costume is the trim, then you're copying them. And unless you have permission to copy them, you could have a problem.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out, because I don't know. It's early to see how it's going to be, because, you know, we still don't even know if Supreme Court is going to take the case or not.
Well, and the current makeup of the court and the whole controversy over whether or not they're going to replace the, you know, fill the ninth slot anytime soon, this could actually be pushed back quite a ways. We're talking, you know, if nothing happens until the next president, you're looking at a year, year and a half before they'd likely even hear the case.
Now, as for, say, copywriting a costume, I can fully understand that. I mean, no Time Warner would want, you know, the Superman costume to be licensable. So you have that aspect of the appearance. But the thing is, it really comes down to, is somebody profiting from it or cutting into their profits? And that's ultimately what it's going to come down to. And now you've got the issue with Varsity, you know, suing another company over that. I think it's going to be quite a bit different from what you get for the cosplay. Cosplay is not a for-profit thing per se, unless they're doing the pictures and that and the appearances.
Well, and there could also be a threshold that they. I mean, one of the ways around this that could save everybody's legal department, you know, a lot of money and time would be, you know, a profit threshold. You know, you have to make X amount of money to be worth the lawyer's time.
I think the other thing too is that if you've got something like, you mentioned the Superman outfit, really, since that's to start with a print design, I could see where the copyright would fall in on that, because your copyright extends to a work of art and not a functional piece of clothing. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Because they're upset about just a trim. That's my understanding, that they're upset about a hem, the hems of the skirts, and I lost interest, because it was like, that's what they're mad about. I can't see the fight. I don't know where the fight is. That if you're talking about functionality, I mean, it's just like what Tim was saying earlier. Jeans are jeans. A cheerleading outfit is a cheerleading outfit. They've got to be able to fly through the air. They've got to be able to do all these things. There's a certain material to it for it to look like a cheerleading outfit. So, yeah, they're all going to look the same. And they're constantly, oh, that's cute, we're going to do something like that too. But when I was looking at the lawsuit itself, what else are you going to do on a cheerleading outfit but put a little hem on it?
Well, I think it's going a bit beyond that, because you're looking at...
The cut?
You're talking about this. You're talking about more than just functionality. You're talking about the appearance of it. It's almost like on shoes. You had a company who was being sued because of how many stripes were on the side. It was too close to another one. And then you find, like, in, say, high fashion, you know, London, New York, L.A., Paris, where you have these fashion runway type of things, and they each designer has a specific styling,
right,
or, you know, specific elements, and then if somebody goes in and copies them, it's like they're impeding on their territory.
Yeah, so, exactly, because you have the Christian who's got the red, sorry, you talked about shoes now. You know, he's got that distinctive, the bottom of the shoe is red, and that's his thing. And no other designer can do that, or can they not? I mean, all it is a color. You know, you paint your sole of your shoe red, but everybody knows that that's Christian's shoe. Mm-hmm. That's his thing. And so that's where it's kind of like, okay, I kind of understand, because if I were to go around painting my shoe, the bottom of my shoe red, and then trying to make money off of that, I don't think Christian would care. He's got millions of dollars. But yeah, that is taking something that belonged to him. That's his thing.
Yeah, but it's exactly like those shoes, the Nike swoosh, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it comes down to lawsuits over the number of stripes, because each brand wants to say, that's ours. You know, that distinguishes us. You know, and so because of that, that's their trademark, that's their copyright, that's your thing. Don't step on it, especially if you're making money from it.
Right, exactly, because that's his shoe. That's his thing. Everybody knows that he does that to the bottom of his shoes.
And so when it comes down to the outfit thing, you know, the functionality of something, okay, unless it's a prop or something, I can understand that. But when it's the appearance of it that identifies a character, I can see where it can be copyrighted and that type of thing. The only problem is, should cosplayers be worried about it if that's the way it turns out? Because if they're not making any money off of it, and all they're doing is helping to promote the brand, and they're not infringing on any licensing, then are they going to be facing any trouble?
Right.
But, you know, but remember too, like, because this does come back into a copyright aspect of it. And I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I just watch a lot of lawyer TV shows. But but remember though that one of the primary functions is not whether you make a profit from it or not. It's not whether you even use it commercially. You know, even if you went nonprofit, it doesn't protect you. But the thing is like it comes back down to the fact though that these companies can selectively enforce. Are they going to go after every fan who decides to, you know, dress up as a, you know, as a Powerpuff Girl or Powerpuff, what are those? I was trying to sound cool, and I really messed that one up.
Yes.
You know, so, like, are they going to go after every Power Ranger, you know, just because they're dressing up as a Power Ranger? No. You know, it probably not. Most likely not. But, you know, but will it maybe? But it's like, but we're talking about the fact that, well, can they sue if somebody sells? They can do that now. If I started selling, you know, if I started selling Power Ranger suits right now, they could come and shut me down. They can sue me for copyright infringement now. This case, I don't think would even affect that, really. I think what it's coming down to is exactly what you can, like, how specific can you get, which I think is what you guys are saying, like, you know, one stripe or two stripes, or, you know, how specific.
That's where my problem, I guess that's what I'm getting at, is I don't see their fight. Everybody else that in the genre has a bigger fight against cosplay than this cheerleader fight.
Well, also,
you know what I mean? It's like their fight. Yeah, their fight isn't big enough for me when you got the people that have a bigger fight not doing anything.
Yeah, but something else you need to consider. Well, we might consider again. I'm not a lawyer. You know, surprise, surprise. We don't have any lawyers here. But what it comes down to is. If it's not intruding or impeding on their profitability and on their use, if there's no prevention of profit or anything like that, or they're not turning profit in that case, at what point does it fall under, say, fair use rather than rather than copyright.
Well, fair use.
It's not going to do anything with fair use, because fair use, you know, people, and that's one of the things that people were saying with the Axanar thing. Fair use. Well, no, fair use only really applies if you're doing any kind of a spoof or a parody, or if you're doing something that is transformative in nature. That's one of the key elements of fair use of any kind of intellectual property. If you're doing a critique, if you're doing commentary, if you're doing some sort of analysis or review or something like that, if you're using it for an academic paper or such, then those are some instances where you have fair use. If you are making some sort of comment or analysis of the original work, then you can do something to that original work as part of your process. Fair use covers all of that. Fair use does not sit there and say, oh, well, I can make a Star Trek film. Fair use doesn't say, I can make a Starfleet uniform and I can sell it. Because
about selling it.
Well, and like Michael said, the profitability doesn't really factor into it. It's ownership. It's ownership of a particular thing, and the thing is the design, or the logo, or the music, or whatever that is owned by some entity, whether it's an individual person, you know, a songwriter or a singer or a publisher or a film studio. They own it. And, you know, if you want to move, Michael mentioned the Power Rangers. You look at what happened with that dark Power Rangers fan film that got made, that Saban sat there and went, no, you're going to take it down. And then they made a deal and they could put it back up as long as there was something that said, this is a fan film. It doesn't have anything to do with Saban Brands. And, you know, we saw this with Marvel not too long ago. Right after the Axanar lawsuit hit, about a week later, Marvel issued a takedown notice on that animated X-Men Danger Room Protocols, where, you know, you had this guy who spent all of his life savings and went an entire year building this web series based on the 1990s animated X-Men characters. And he got one episode out on YouTube, and it got pulled, and he put it on Vimeo, and it got pulled. And then he comes out and says, well, sorry, it's been canceled because Marvel told us to pull it down. And everybody makes Marvel the bad guy, when Marvel is well within their rights to stop this stuff because they own the property. They own it. And it's theirs.
And that's the thing, and that's what it kind of comes back to. And Daniel, I just wanted to kind of, you know, and I wanted to clarify, because Daniel actually made a really good point where, you know, where it comes down, because money does come into this at some point. It doesn't come into the finding of whether it's copyright infringement or not. You know, what the money comes down to in the end is damages. You know, how much of damages can somebody collect then? You know, like, if they make profits, do I get to collect those? Did they take profits away from me? Do I get to collect that? So at some point, the money that is made, or the money that you cost somebody who owns that intellectual property, that comes into play. You know, this other guy too, you know, with this X-Men, you know, cartoon, I feel bad that he sunk his life savings and everything into it, but Jason, you're absolutely right. He sunk all of his life savings. If he wants to be this creative and put his money into something and make something really cool and be creative about it, and you want to spend every last dime you have doing it, then make it original. Because if you're going to take something that is owned by somebody else, you take a risk. Every fan film that's out there, every bit of fan fiction that's out there, everything where that is not under fair use, that you're utilizing somebody else's IP, you do so at your own risk. Because if you make a fan film, CBS and Paramount, like for Star Trek, can step in at any time. You do a Star Wars thing, Disney can step in any minute. You know, they might let a few go, but they can step in at any time. And so I don't have a lot of sympathy for people who sink a lot of money into these things, these fan projects, because in the end, they don't own it. If they really want to make something great, you know, make it original.
Well, and the other thing, too, is you mentioned Star Wars. They're doing the Fan Film Awards again, which is a controlled, limited opportunity for fans to make their fan fiction that is maybe not necessarily sanctioned by Disney and Lucasfilm, but there's a venue there. It's the for a participation agreement between Lucasfilm and Disney and the fans. And there's a proper way to do it. And they're basically saying, okay, we're going to give you these sound effects and these music elements. You guys go make your fan films, and they control the access. They're controlling the path for people to be able to access these fan films. And maybe that's the way that other studios should be looking at this kind of stuff, where, you know, and people have even said, you know, CBS and Paramount could profit from this if they licensed fan films and were, you know, had some mechanism in place so that the fan created works, whether it's fan fiction or fan web comics or
a subsidiary of some sort,
where it's an officially licensed derivative work that then could be, you know, wherever you can find it on the web, rather than all of this stuff out there being in violation of copyright. But then you get into
It gets interesting with Star Wars, because then all this is happening, and then all of a sudden Star Wars opens up a contest. Well, we're going to accept your fan films. Go ahead and make them, you know? And we have a
right. And it's
place
not,
for them.
And it's not new. I mean, the fan films have been going on for a while, but there were, I think, a couple of years there. I think they stopped in 2012, and then it came back last year, if I remember. And it seems that it's one of these, you know, if you can't beat them, join them type things, where, you know, Lucasfilm has recognized people are going to make this stuff. Well, we might as well use it. Let's use it to our advantage. Let's turn it around so it works for us rather than complicates things in terms of, you know, the copyright or whatever else is going on.
From a profitability standpoint, that seems to be the logical thing. I think it ultimately, at the end of the day, is going to come down to figuring out a model that the people who own it get a financial return on people using it. I think the question may become, is it ultimately financially viable to go after every cosplayer on the planet? Which seems to me to be an incredibly expensive and a very, very hard thing to enforce kind of thing. And or if there's a way to sit there and say, hey, give us a dollar. You know, that's a lot of dollars. Give us $10. That's a lot of money that, you know, they could very, very easily come up with, you know, an inexpensive solution to solve the problem.
Something I might add, again, going to something that I did say earlier. The reason I ask, you know, like I say, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an expert on copyright law or intellectual properties, but I know with a lot of conventional lawsuits, one thing that must be proven is not that was the law violated, but was there harm? Was there harm done in the process? And that's why I ask, would they, you know, when it comes down to just individual cosplayers, would they have a case if they cannot prove that harm was done?
Well, and I think that goes back to Michael's point about damages, because if you look at something like the Nerdist making those Justice League holiday films with all of the vulgarity and the crude language and the adult situations. And I look at that and I think, okay, I get that it's a parody, but it's a parody that's really putting the Justice League in a terrible place. And it really surprised me that DC let them do it. I think that's one of those things where it's a case by case thing, where the people that own the copyright are going to decide each individual time whether or not they're going to pursue anything. But, you know, it's like we had said before, if you go after every single one of these people, that's all you're going to be doing all the time. So, yeah, it's, I don't know. It would be nice in a perfect world if everybody got along and, you know, the people that owned the intellectual property said, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. You know, but we don't live in a perfect world, I guess.
Could also be that you have the, say, Axnar versus the Nerdist. The Nerdist has a huge longtime following, whereas Axnar is the new kid on the block. They're easier to target with a smaller fan base.
It could be. But I think in Axanar's case, you've got the main element for the Axanar thing is the whole building of a commercial venture off of the reputation of Star Trek, and that's just a big no-no. All right. Well, we will be watching it closely and continue to update on various different cases as they present themselves, and see what happens. If the cheerleader case goes to the Supreme Court, we'll keep an eye on that, and we will definitely be keeping an eye on the Axanar suit. And then, of course, go check out 1701 News when they break their story about whether or not they have a script of Axanar.
Yes, I really want to. I'm looking forward to reading that very much.
Yes. Michael Hinman, I want to thank you for joining us, editor-in-chief at 1701news.com.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And the rest of the gang of meddling kids, Sonia Rodriguez down in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Hello, bye-bye.
Dan Handley here in Kansas City.
Good night, everyone.
As well as Timothy Harvey.
Always a pleasure, guys.
And all of you out there listening, we want to thank you for being here as well. Don't forget, you can subscribe to all of our shows through iTunes or your podcast player of choice. We do have a newsletter, and you can get all of the latest headlines over at scififorme.com. And if you have thoughts that you'd like to share with us, there's a couple of ways you can do it. You can leave a comment in all the different available spaces, or you can send us an email, echochamber@scififorme.com. And of course, we're on all of the social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest, Google+, YouTube, and Tumblr. And that's going to do it for us this time. Thanks very much for joining us in the Echo Chamber here on Sci-Fi for Me Radio. And we will be back with another episode very soon.
This has been a presentation of Sci-Fi for Me Radio. Copyright 2016 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio,